You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 26, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, I am taking the second week of my paternity leave following the funeral of my grandmother. Those days, it's a mess. But folks, I leave you in the good hands today of the producers of the Majority Report, Matt, those two guys. And so enjoy. Here they are to tell you what's going to be happening on today's show.
Well, the first thing that will be happening on today's show is I will correct Sam Cedar for getting the date very wrong. Today is March 25th, 2013, and it is not the 26th. That is tomorrow. But joining you now is myself, Matt Binder.
And Michael Brooks, the producers of The Majority Report. He did say that the audience was in good hands, which I appreciate.
Better hands than him, actually.
At least knowing the date hands.
That's frankly true.
Well, he does have a new baby, so probably if
the days are all just meshed together.
If I end up ever having a kid, I'll probably get like months off, let alone dates. We have a great show for you today, folks. A lot of good things. In just a minute or so, I'm going to be talking with Heather McGee. She's the Vice President of Policy and Outreach at Demos, which is one of the premier progressive think tanks in the country, on democracy, social mobility, inequality, all the good stuff in the Majority Report wheelhouse. Then talk about Cyprus. Matt has some truly, I'm going to do a twofer here, stunning and unbelievable stories coming at you later.
They are pretty stunning and unbelievable.
They're just
stories that you might think are straight from the headlines of The Onion, but believe me, they are not.
They are
sadly
absolutely not. We've double-checked. But first off, and then just really quick housekeeping for the rest of this week. We have pre-recorded shows that Sam did. So even though we're on vacation, excellent shows for you, as always.
It's like we're on a live show vacation, but we're not really on a vacation. There'll still be videos going up on YouTube,
yeah.
Brand new shows for the podcast. You know, it's – who else does this?
No one else does this. And also, folks, we're going to go to the take a break in just a minute. I'm going to come back with Heather McGee. We're going to have a freebie Monday, and in response, we request one new member or one donation equivalent of a new member. Please.
Yes, we've decided we're going to make today a freebie Monday because it's the vacation week. So as if there's not going to be enough material for all you freebies and members anyway, which we're going to provide the following days, today will be additional material as well. So to make sure we do not get fired when Sam comes back next Tuesday, let's say that, you know, oh, look, Sam, we gave freebie Monday, but look at all these members and or donations that came out of it.
All right, folks, give us a minute. We'll be right back with Heather McGee.
Killers of walk like Pistol Pete and Pappy Mason gave the young boys admiration. Prince from Queens and Fritz from Harlem, street legends. The drugs kept the hood from starving.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the world's leading provider of audiobooks. You can check out titles from any of your favorite authors for free at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report.
Why not download a free copy of The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future by Joseph Stiglitz. This is just what I was talking with Heather McGee about. You can get it for free today by being a listener of The Majority Report at
audiblepodcast.com/majority report.
Do it today.
It's free!
Pushing cars, Nicky Barnes was the 70s, but there's a long list of high-profile celebrities. Worldwide on the thorough side of things, live as kings, some died, one guy, one time, they grasped me. As I'm about to blast heat, 40 side of burning, I turn while he asks me, what you up to, the cops gonna bust you. I was a teen drunk or brute, stumbled, I wondered if God sent him, cause two squad cars entered the block and looked at us, I ain't flinched when they watched.
Welcome back, I'm Michael Brooks, joining me now is Heather McGee. She's the Vice President for Policy and Outreach at Demos. Hi, Heather. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me, Michael.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So recently, you guys released a report called Stacked Deck, which kind of goes into some real detail about how wealth inequality is really eroding the quality of American democracy and really kind of misaligning our priorities. And I think that this probably confirms a lot of people's intuitive impressions of what's going on. But you guys go into much sort of greater detail in this report and connect a lot of dots. So I'm just wondering if you could give what you think the kind of key takeaways are from this report and what the most sort of important lessons to draw from it are.
Yeah, I mean, we at Demos went about to try to really put some numbers and see what the most rigorous political and social science research was saying about the link between political inequality and economic inequality. And you're totally right, Michael, that it seems absolutely intuitive. You know, we know that when people who have a lot of money because of our campaign finance system are able to influence elections and to hold sway over politicians once they're in office, the politicians are going to cater to their interests. But what we wanted to tease out was how much their interests were misaligned with the vast majority of working Americans, and particularly on economic issues. Because if you kind of think about, you know, your sort of Bloomberg billionaire, you know, gun control, right? That's something that he really cares about. That's not so different from the rest of us. There's no reason why a wealthy person would have a different opinion than working and middle class people on social issues, issues of environmental protections, issues of marriage equality and civil rights. But where the social and political science research really found that these interests diverge is when it comes to the basic questions about how the economy should be ordered, right? How high the minimum wage should be, how high taxes should be, the role of regulations in the corporate structure. Also things about different priorities. For example, the report Stacked Deck showed that, you know, wealthy people think that higher education should be invested in, absolutely, think that there should be more money in education. But more importantly, they think that taxes should be low and the deficit should be addressed. And so when it comes down to that prioritization, a lot of their deficit cutting and tax cutting interests went out over the, you know, sheer necessity of more revenue in order to pay for higher education, which wealthy respondents to public opinion polls always say they support.
Right, right. No, that makes perfect sense. And I think another kind of important thing to highlight from this report, which really struck me, was that you say that lower income voters are voting at higher rates than they have, I think, since the mid-1960s. And I thought that was very interesting because there's this kind of I would say that there's a certain – even among some people on the left, there's this kind of comfortable narrative of like, well – you just need to activate certain constituencies. You need to get people voting. You need to get people kind of in the process in a certain way. And then naturally there'll be a response to their policy concerns. And I think what we've seen, you know, yeah, the numbers are up, according to this report, highest since the mid-1960s. You saw African-American voters, you know, facing down kind of systemic efforts to disenfranchise them to still exercise their right to vote. But yet in the broader context of this report, not just through voting but civic life, political influence and participation, lower income voters are really systemically screened out even as they're sort of theoretically doing what everybody's been saying they're supposed to do. Is that right?
It is right. So basically, you know, one of the reasons I, in the beginning of my career, got into policy areas around the questions of what the rules are on voting is because of that concept, right? That if everyone voted at the same rates as the wealthiest, that we would have a different shape of our democracy. I mean, if you walk around the halls of Congress and you talk to, you know, even the Nancy Pelosi's of the world, they'll say that one of the problems with protecting, you know, food stamps and Medicaid is that, quote unquote, the poor don't vote.
Right.
What we've seen is that, and I think it does have to do with the radicalization of our politics and the growing inequality and how much people who feel like they have something at stake and decisions are being made in capitals in Washington that are affecting them in their very homes, we have seen the rates of voter participation go up among working class folks, among low income folks, among people of color, and among youth. However, still, there is a significant gap between the lowest income households' voting rates and the highest income households. And part of that has to do with the rules of our election process. I mean, we've got this arcane system that is really wrapped up in red tape, needless red tape, so that for people who are, you know, working three jobs, who move a lot, mobility rates are a lot higher among as you go down the economic ladder. It is needlessly complex to make sure that you are registered to vote in the right place, in many cases 30 days before an election. So that's part of the agenda, has to be, yes, making sure that donors don't have more power than voters in doing campaign finance reform, but also to make sure that all voters have the same power to exercise their freedom to vote. And that means things like same-day registration, universal registration, really saying that as a government we have to have a commitment to lowering the barriers to voting.
It's almost like there's two tracks that I see in this report in kind of democratic participation. It's sort of like an, you know, an airport or something where you have business class and everything is kind of designed to get people faster and faster access and easier, more and more comfortable seating. And then everybody else has more barriers and wait a second, that's a delay, that's a problem, this is a new form of identification you need to show. That's sort of what it seems like, that we have this fast track process and then this other process that is, gets more and more bureaucratic, more and more cumbersome for really just having most people's voices heard in the process.
That's a really great image, Michael. I might have to steal that from you. I like that a lot. And that really is the case. I mean, you've got people who, you know, pay the extra amount to do the clear thing, right? And so they don't even have to show their ID anymore. They just sort of flash their card and they whiz right through. And it's true. I mean, if you talk to elected officials, the process of having to raise big money in, you know, $10,000 or more checks means that you spend your evenings and your days calling through people with high net worth,
right,
who can afford to write those checks. And you listen to their concerns day in and day out. And those are the phone calls you have to answer. And those are the people you have to meet with. And those are the people you have to have $500 plate fundraisers with. And it simply distorts the political voice that is being heard in the halls of power. And when you look at how much the donor class tends to be far more obsessed with the deficit versus job creation, which makes a lot of sense because right. they don't want a deficit that will eventually cause higher taxes, and they aren't very sensitive to the massive unemployment that we're seeing in the country. And so it really does make a difference, and I don't think there's any better example of the dominance of the donor class over our political agenda than the deficit obsession that we have seen at a time of near depression for the rest of the country.
Right. No, that's the kind of next point I want to get into, and also what we'll tie into sort of in the next step is you've written an excellent piece recently on clean election laws, which we'll get to soon. But you said something that I found really striking, and I actually don't remember whether it was in a television interview or an article or maybe even a conversation we had, where you said that kind of deficit obsession is, first of all, it's a misalignment, as I think we've established in this conversation, as you've established, the report established, between a very small sector of society and really the broader base of Americans, not just, working, lower-income Americans, but really even a very broad middle class of Americans mm-hmm. that are, facing this jobs crisis and this kind of anemic economy. But you've said that this deficit obsession is also about a real fear of democracy. And I just think that's fascinating because if you look in the Eurozone, this austerity budget, deficit fetishism is much clearer in terms of the sort of anti-democratic tendency because you basically have Eurozone ministers imposing these really harsh budgets on, places like Greece or Spain. That's very explicit. In America, it's less direct in a certain sense. It's more like these kind of complicated and delayed processes like the sequester and things like that. But at the same time, through both the obsession with the wrong issue to begin with and then locking ourselves into these agreements that delay our ability to really respond and anticipate to what the actual crisis is, you're seeing this real, what you call the real fear of democracy and the future. And I just love for you to get into more of that idea with us now.
Sure. I think this was actually on Up with Chris Hayes that I said that. It okay. was... basically, you're right. I think it's a really great example to show how it's vastly undemocratic what's going on in Europe, and that you really have sort of bureaucrats from other countries right. dictating the terms of your own country's budget. But here, it is similar in the sense that you've got elected officials who may be your representative in Congress or the Senate, but who are fundamentally beholden to someone other than the vast majority of their constituents, which is the donor class. And we had about 40 years of a mounting economic conventional wisdom that basically broke with the financial crisis of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
The inequality era sort of collapsed in and on itself, and we had the orthodoxy that said that regulation was bad, that taxes needed to be low, and that capital needed to have all of the power in our shared sort of economic ecosystem really, really show itself to be deeply flawed, not just in terms of measurements of how well most of the country was doing between the gap between wages and productivity, the stagnating incomes at the middle and declining at the bottom, while they were skyrocketing at the top, all of that, but then actually showed that it was terrible for capitalism itself.
Right.
There was an incredible opportunity for a realignment politically coming out of the financial crisis, and I do believe that the people who had been calling the shots for a very long time became terrified of what that would mean, became terrified of the idea of the kind of economic realignment that happened after the first Gilded Age in this country and after the resulting crash, where we really did do a new economic order and a new paradigm. And as long as this paradigm, which is one that tolerates and in fact encourages inequality, one that is deeply unresponsive to what keeps working families up at night, the rising cost of college, job quality, child care, you're going to have the potential for a well-functioning democracy to make huge changes. And so it is very scary for, you know, to use the civil word, the plutocrats, to think that we would have a responsive democracy where the desires of people to see a real realignment in our economy and a real government response to these pressing economic issues could just happen. And so the only way to tie the hands of that are, A, to make sure that the campaign finance system becomes less and less regulated so that the big money can continue to flow to shape the agenda in Washington, but also to put a fiscal straitjacket on what could be the government's response. I mean, if you look at all these debates around what percentage GDP there can be in government spending, you know, that's all a number. It's 18, it's 20, it's 21. But each percentage of GDP represents something that could be a real game changer for working families, right? So it's like half a percentage point GDP for free college, right?
Right.
You know, another third of a percentage point GDP for universal child care, really, truly universal child care, right? So deeper, more robust retirement more robust retirement for the government to pick up that tab since employers have been walking away from that obligations and pension security. So these are the type of things that could be on the table if we had a more responsive democracy. So when I say that there's a fear of democracy, it really is about the people who have been calling the shots for the past 40 years being very afraid that the effects of the shots that they have called, the effect of having such a stacked deck are going to really awaken a democratic polity that's going to demand a lot more. And the only way to make sure that doesn't happen is to keep us in this austerity straitjacket.
Right. No, and I just have to say parenthetically, I like that you say that plutocrats is the polite word or civil word. I thought that's funny. So do you think, though, just to sort of one kind of addendum on this question, there's this idea of – so – there's the money and the special interest component, obviously, and we're going to, of course, elaborate on that further. But then there's this other idea that I think it was Simon Johnson, who's at MIT, I think, kind of – he wrote a book about the financial crisis, and he said also had this notion that there's the idea of kind of like cognitive capture in the Washington and policy class, that part of it is there is this kind of corruption of special interest money, but there's also just this inability to think – outside of these really, really narrow policy initiatives and frameworks that people have been operating out of for decades. So even as the kind of overwhelming empirical evidence comes in that it doesn't work, that there's a serious problem, that people still cannot kind of access a different way of thinking. What do you think of that way of looking at it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a major part of it, particularly when it comes to regulators and people who are not – theoretically, you know, raising campaign funds, although, of course, they are looking for the next job when they leave office, and so often it is a revolving door to industry. A lot of it has to do with the lobbying that happens, and, you know, I mean, I've had many regulator meetings, and I know that I and my colleagues are the only people who are coming in for weeks at a time who are not saying, you know, you need to really go easy on the firms to make sure that there's still liquidity and these regulations are onerous. So it's like when politicians are calling through donor lists, if you're really hearing all the time, these very well-educated, well-dressed, powerful, and rich people saying that if you act in what is the broad public interest, you will crash the economy and you will be, you know, sort of excoriated as one of the, you know, sort of stupid Luddites.
Right.
That does have an impact on your on your worldview. So we definitely have that issue. And I think it's also very hard when you think about sort of Washington as a place and how much the sort of professional lobbying and sort of, you know, for defense, it's the defense industrial, but also just sort of like the regulatory industrial influence peddling class that surrounds itself in Washington comes from, you know, a very narrow slice of the American people. And there is a conventional wisdom, and it is fundamentally conservative, even if people do have sort of liberal tendencies on various issues. It's fundamentally conservative in the sort of classic sense of the term, in terms of conservative of against change, and very disapproving of radical notions that would really disrupt the day to day, because the status quo is really fine in Washington.
Right.
That's the problem, right? Right? There is not a lot of economic pain among the people who are setting policies, and they don't see a lot of economic pain. I mean, the capital has been booming.
Right.
And so it's really hard to think I would leave the – I would set aside the rules that are creating this status quo because something else is really urgent, when there's really just, frankly, a bit too much comfort among our policy elite.
Right, and a certainly a kind of lack of empathy and humanizing outside of those really narrow confines. Now, you have a great new piece in the New York Amsterdam News talking about a clean elections bill that I think is it currently in the New York State Legislature, I think.
It is.
Yeah, I'd love you to just talk what's in that bill. Why is it important? What's that about?
Yeah, so, I mean, we have a chance here in New York, I'm in New York, to have the first, to be the first state post-Citizens United to pass really fundamental transformational campaign finance reform. And this bill that's currently being considered by the state legislature and is backed at least nominally by Governor Cuomo would do a few things. One, it would lower the sort of sky-high contribution limits that the finance system currently has in Albany. Most importantly, it would match donations, private small dollar donations, up to 6-1, which is basically replicating the New York City system. And so it means, in practicality, that instead of, you know, going to those $500 plate fundraisers, candidates for office in Albany would be door knocking in their neighborhoods, listening to the concerns of their actual constituents, getting small dollar donations and having them match so that they meant that a $50 donation meant hundreds of dollars to them. And we've seen that at the city level with the same kind of public match, the donations in neighborhoods like Bedford-Stuyvesant, the Bronx, Harlem, the South Bronx, Chinatown, where they're more working-class neighborhoods, are multiple times, often as much as 24 times more important to the city council representatives of those neighborhoods than those donations are to the state legislative council, to the state legislators in those neighborhoods, because state legislators are still working under that broken system. So.
Right.
It's something that could be a real game changer, is completely constitutional under the court's sort of current jurisprudence, and would really diversify the donor base as well as potentially who can run, right? You don't have to be a millionaire or know a millionaire to run if you have publicly financed elections. So basically between now and the end of the session in Albany early this summer, there's got to be a lot of pressure put on state legislators and on Cuomo to make good on this promise.
Yeah, no, and so just really in terms of the calling your representatives, having a very kind of active public voice in this, and this thing really does have a shot at passing?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It is something that, you know, I mean, Governor Cuomo really prides himself on his efficacy, and he has put himself out here and saying he wants to be, you know, the campaign finance reform governor and the first one after Citizens United. He's been doing lots of public statements about it. And so that means that basically if he hears from the people of New York and as well from, you know, particularly from progressives across the country, that this is something that they're watching, it's going to mean he'll do what it takes to push it over the line. You know, I mean, I think the governor is looking at 2016. He wants to have his bona fides. He, you know, pushed through gun control right after Newtown, and I think he's looking to make a name for himself on this issue. And I think he also recognizes, to be a little less cynical about it, that the system is broken and that Albany is one of the most dysfunctional legislatures in the country, and people are able to use sort of shell corporations to give $500,000 unrestricted gifts that get funneled to candidates, and that you know, when it comes down to it, elected officials actually don't like to spend all their time fundraising. They would like to be freed from that. And we're about to release a report at Demos that looks at the experience of Connecticut, which has
I'd love for you to get into that.
Yeah. So in Connecticut, after the governor was put in jail, in 2008, they passed a public financing system that is similar to what's being proposed in New York. And what the Demos report authors saw when they did a bunch of interviews with different interest groups and public interest groups and legislators, current and former, from Connecticut, was that it was really a brand new kind of politics after public financing. Legislators listened a lot more to their constituents than they did to lobbyists. Lobbyists just didn't have the power that they had before under the broken system because they couldn't come with checks in one hand and a bill model legislation in the other. And people really felt like there was sort of a change in the tenor of politics in Connecticut. And for, you know, what matters to me, the policies changed. You saw after 2008 policies that impact working and middle-class families getting a fair hearing and, in fact, passing. We saw paid sick days. We saw an increase in the minimum wage. We saw an in-state DREAM Act. So these are a lot of things that when, you know, as the StatDeck report shows, when people who are the donor class are setting the agenda, where is the minimum wage and paid sick days going to be in the list of priorities? Not very high. But once you have a finance system that is actually relying on working and middle-class donors, you see a difference in the policy.
Right. No, and the case of Connecticut, and by the way, I just want to say the name of your piece in the New York Amsterdam News is Let the People Pay the Piper. And the Connecticut example is really inspiring, I think, also because, you know, Connecticut doesn't necessarily have the, you know, an image of a state like, you know, maybe Vermont or something, of being kind of relatively small or clean or something. I mean, as you said, the governor went to jail. There's been a lot of issues in Connecticut. So if this has a serious impact in Connecticut, it's a really powerful model. And, yeah, if you live outside of New York, Albany is pretty unbelievable. Kind of notorious. So this could be a great testing ground for that as well. But I think what's the kind of really important takeaway, and maybe the way to kind of wrap this all together, is that there is this – the social issues, it's all interconnected, obviously, and the social issues are profoundly important and key, whether it's marriage equality or gun control or the environment. But there is this entire base of economic issues that really are going to the heart of really the future of whether we're going to continue to have mobility and kind of upward growth and people having an opportunity to go out and fulfill their potential or even just have security and dignity as they retire and as they live their lives. And the disconnect between a donor class and those policies that affect people sort of being achieved are really, really vital. So that these kind of things like clean elections and stuff like that, they're not just sort of nice, good government issues. They really go to the heart of whether or not we're going to have policies and policies passed and legislated that address the kind of core crisis facing middle class, working class people today.
That's exactly right. And I'll just leave you with this sort of killer fact.
Please.
From a Princeton political scientist, Larry Bartels. He ran the numbers and found that when the opinion of the working and middle class diverged from the sort of donor class, the elected officials' behavior so closely tracked with that of the donor class that, in fact, the bottom third of the income distribution had no apparent impact, zero, on the behavior of their elected officials.
Wow. That's really disheartening, but the lesson and the place we can be optimistic about is that if we follow your lead and we pass clean elections and things like that, then we all can become the donor class and hopefully have a more responsive politics.
That's great.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Heather. It's just great talking with you.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it.
Okay. Take good care.
Bye-bye.
That was Heather McGee. She is the Vice President of Policy and Outreach at Demos.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Especially that last point.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what I found so important about that report and why I wanted to – I mean, you know, I think Heather's great. I really admire her a lot. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk so much about that report with her is because I think that there's something about when we kind of have – like we all sort of know, okay, so wealthy people have a totally disproportionate influence in our politics, or we have this kind of closed-loop discussion that emphasizes a deficit obsession versus recreating jobs or renewing the middle class and opportunity. And we all kind of know that. But when you really start to get into the numbers and you really start to get into the stats, it's way more shocking than just like generically knowing that, you know? It's so – that's why I kind of found it unbelievable and wanted to highlight that work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So go ahead.
I mean – yeah, I mean like you said, yeah, we you know it, this is what happened. But just to hear like just – like you said, number-wise, just how little that, unless you're in that special class of people, how little you influence what the people who are supposed to be representing you do.
And even if you're...
Just go ahead.
No, I think that's kind of... I mean, the only thing was, I think that she gave some good sense of optimism and where we could work. So it's not all kind of pessimistic. But I do think...
It's optimistic that there's people working to fix the problem. But at the same time, you kind of know that things aren't going to happen as optimistically as we'd like.
It's going to be a long slog. I mean, yeah. It's going to take a lot of work. But I think that... you know, I guess it's also too that even the kind of generic like stuff you learn in a civics class, like more people are voting, more people are making calls, and that's great, and that is important, but it's so clearly not enough because of the systemic barriers that are thrown up. It's really kind of, you know, stunning and amazing and unbelievable, and really important. Just want to go over this.
So. Want to go to a break?
Oh, yeah.
So you could get into a new mode because we're switching to a completely
different. Dude, let's take a break. That's a great – you know, actually, I'm going to abuse this. That was a good idea. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Just want to go over this really quick. Cyprus, the Eurozone and Cyprus have agreed to a bank bailout. If you've been following it last week, the Cypriot banks kind of went into crisis over the past, I think, beginning last week. And then the initial response to the Cypriot banking crisis was basically to restore liquidity in the banks by imposing taxes on every single person's savings in the bank, including from the lowest level depositors. So people obviously were enraged. There was a huge reaction against this. And now the Eurozone and the Cypriot government has come up with a new bailout package, which will basically wind down Cyprus's second largest bank. And under the agreement, all deposits of less than 100,000 euros will be secured. So all those with deposits of less than 100,000 euros will not pay any tax or have a levy imposed on them. And then the Laki Bank, which is the second largest bank in Cyprus, will be winded down to sort of restore liquidity and restore the system. I think it's interesting, you know, there was a fear of contagion, but Cyprus obviously is a very, very tiny, tiny portion of the EU economy. I think that the only sort of the kind of broader lessons here, first of all, are one is that the initial proposal to levy a tax on everybody is shocking. I mean, it's just another kind of classic and really crude example of, I mean, of externalizing the losses, obviously. Russia doesn't like this agreement necessarily because a lot of the large depositors in Cypriot banks are Russians. So there's a kind of questionable sort of money source in Cyprus. And look, Cyprus has had a very irresponsible banking policy, which in fact they've based off of the kind of deregulation and liberalization that we have followed. So it's sort of caught up with them in that way. I think the other kind of important takeaway here is in the sort of broader Eurozone, which is that you could almost look at EU expansion in some respects as a bubble as well. Because you basically had a lot of countries coming in and getting kind of cleared for EU membership that clearly did not meet the standards that the EU had established for membership in terms of economic performance, in terms of lack of corruption, in terms of transparency. And, you know, one of the things that's very important to bear in mind is not only – and look, and to be clear – there is corruption in places like Cyprus and Greece and Spain and Portugal, and there is serious inefficiency, and there is some really big problems in those countries' bureaucracies. But when you look at places like, again, Greece and Spain being a good example of this, that kind of had real estate booms and a lot of speculation that led to these crashes, or in Cyprus with a deregulated kind of casino banking sector, the same kind of core Eurozone countries like Germany that now are imposing really brutal austerity on places like Greece profited immensely from real estate booms in places like Greece. So all of the contractors, the building contractors, building equipment, loans, bank liquidity that places like Greece needed to sustain a housing bubble or a fake boom or whatever else was supplied by the Germans and supplied by the core Eurozone members. So now they kind of turn around and, you know, are imposing really harsh austerity and giving a lot of lessons about responsibility. But it wasn't like they weren't profiting immensely from the irresponsibility of the southern zone countries. And then also the fact that a lot of countries are sort of cleared for EU membership, even though there was no way that they were meeting those standards to begin with. I actually think that the deal that they've ended up striking in Cyprus is probably a best case scenario because utterly crashing and being kind of defaulted out of the Eurozone would certainly be totally devastating for Cyprus. I don't know necessarily how much of a contagion it would have had across Europe, but it certainly would have hit Cyprus even harder than it's hitting Cyprus now. Then obviously, though, the initial proposal of simply imposing a levy on everybody was ludicrous. And I think actually that wasn't even a Eurozone idea. I think that that was the initial response of the conservative government in Cyprus. So at any rate, it looks like that crisis is being addressed, although obviously there's going to be a lot of pain as a result of that. And just more consequences of a deregulated banking sector. I mean, that's really what this just keeps coming down to. And again, I mean, I know this is like endless goading and it's like a signpost on this show, but like libertarians, 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 deregulated banking sector, like example 3,000,013 of bad consequences.
I don't know. I hear things are going great over there.
Actually, wait, libertarians, I'm sorry. We're just ridiculous with the board, but I have to do this. Banking deregulation has caused bad consequences. Shocking.
Who knew?
Who knew?
More at 11.
More at 11. Banking deregulation might not be such a good idea for an economy or a banking strategy.
But it's worked so well everywhere else.
I know. You have the anomalies, probably. Just there's something culturally about Cyprus that makes it not work.
It's almost as if people expect us to look back at history and see what has worked and what hasn't and take things from there. What preposterous.
You're part of the history-based community. No, but I think, and you know, and actually in some ways what some people pointed out is that, you know, Cyprus implemented this aggressive deregulation. They underwrote Greece. They have all this kind of questionable Russian oligarch money floating around. And the real question is actually how did Cyprus, as this little small, a bifurcated island state, how did it take 5 extra years for their banking institutions to collapse after hours?
Free market, baby. It's the free market. Maybe we would have collapsed 5 years from now if it was for the free, if we were following the true free market system.
It was just like free market, man. It's just like the market, you know, because like when the market happens, people take responsibility and then that's the market.
We should all be more like Cyprus, but not exactly. We should take what they did right and take what they did wrong and just throw both of it away and just do whatever. Free market, baby.
Free market. Rand Paul. Charter schools, vouchers. All right.
Do they have charter schools over there?
No, and that's probably where their banking sector collapsed.
I see.
Because people aren't taking proper responsibility for their education.
It's that liberal stuff they teach over there.
Yeah, it's the residuals of old Europe. But look, they actually are letting a bank essentially collapse and recapitalizing the system. So I think in a way that at least ensures people with deposits under 100,000 euros, and a lot of the kind of upper-end deposits are this again, as I say, not to be stereotypical, but there is definitely some questionable Russian money floating around in the Cypriot system. So the Russians are actually taking a real haircut on this.
That's their first mistake, yeah. letting a bank actually collapse.
No, to be fair, libertarians would be like, let them all collapse, man. It's just like, it's like evolution. I'm sorry. I can't take it seriously. I mean, how can you listen to the Heather McGee interview and look at all of the problems facing modern society and come at us with this nonsense?
Free market, baby. Heather McGee's got to realize if people got the money to donate as much as they want to whoever they want, they should do it, baby. That's how it works. Free market.
See, if you confuse money,
that's how the healthcare system should work. If you know someone who could donate a lot of money, it's up to them to take care of you. Just accept donations, like the church. That's what you got to do.
I don't know if you can hear it on the mic, but Matt is doing this awesome snap, like he's listening to like the Dave Brubeck quartet or something. It's great. I love it. No, but I think it's like you confuse money with ideas, and you confuse competition with innovation. And not that those things can't be connected at times, but those are distinct propositions that you guys just can't seem to get through your heads. So, look, we're going to switch up now to my excellent colleague, Matt Binder.
Which really is only for you to do the videos. Because, like, over audio, you can't tell who's doing what because we're both talking at the same time most of the time.
That's absolutely true. I don't know. And way more people listen to this show over audio. That's a really good point.
So we totally are letting you know we're switching up just so you can, I guess, go watch our YouTube videos.
So you can go watch our YouTube videos, which you totally should. And also to just sort of let you in on the inside of the Majority Report juggernaut process. So we're going to play some music. Do we have music lined up?
Actually, give me one second.
All right.
Because there's something I have to promote over here. Give me a second.
Go ahead. Free market. On marketplace
April,
of ideas.
On April 5th.
Yes.
Our very own Jeff Smith, who you all remember as providing us with probably the most excellent Occupy on-the-ground coverage there was, period, mainstream media, independent media, or otherwise, he is helping to put together, or he's completely involved in doing this by himself. I have no idea how much involvement he has, but I know he is involved in putting together this Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks panel, which our very own Sam Cedar will be taking part of. That's Friday, April 5th.
He'll be moderating.
Sam will be moderating
the panel.
This is Friday, yes. April 5th. I'm not sure of the time yet, but it will be at night in New York City. You'll hear more details as they come, but if you're not doing anything Friday night, April 5th, come see Jeff Smith and Sam Cedar as they discuss WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning with, I'm sure, many, many other excellent guests.
Yeah, that will be a great event. So you guys should go check it out and meet Matt, because Matt will be helping set that up, right?
I may be there early. I may have to. It doesn't matter.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
I will be there.
Look,
to help out for
there
sure.
There is the possibility of an in-person Binder meeting. All right, we're gonna switch up here, folks. Take a little break, and we'll be right back at you with some Well, I didn't know that Fox News was moving to the left and that they didn't cover Benghazi enough, but we learn new things every day.
We do. We do.
All right, we'll be right back.
There's much more, too.
Much, much more. We'll be right back, folks.
And remember, this is a freebie Monday, so keep listening. If you're a freebie, freeloader. We are back on the Majority Report. This is a freebie Monday for all of you freeloaders and members. You'll stick around too. Let me just log into the phone system here. That number, by the way, is 646-257-3920. That is 646-257-3920. If you are a libertarian caller, you can call us at our special libertarian line, which is 646-257-3920. That is 646-257-3920. Conservatives can call the conservative line at 646-257-3920. That is 646-257-3920. And, IM, feel free to IM us at Majority FM using, or you could use any IM client with MajorityFM at jabber.org. Let's go straight to the IMs here, and then we'll get to some stories and calls. It'll be fun. Let's see. All right, cool. Herbowitz, you guys are really getting into this replacement role well. Impressive. I like Sam's 80s alt music better than your selections, though. That's cool. It's all okay. Not everyone has good taste in music. Dradmanthes. Hi, guys. Thanks for another good show. Incidentally, did I hear Marco Rubio in the studio guzzling water during your interview? It's possible. I was drinking my Monster energy drink.
Go for it. Do a Rubio on it for the YouTube. Look, no, you got to look terrified while you do it.
I'm not terrified. I can't do it.
Oh, man.
I'm not as good as an actor.
Matt's just so relaxed. He can't even channel that
I can't even pretend to panic. I can't even pretend to worry.
He can't do it.
Let's see. Clower. Michael, please stop using the phrase based off. Things are based on other things, not based off of other things. Pet peeve. There you go, buddy. It's based on, not based off.
I've definitely heard things based off of other things.
So have I.
But, I mean, apparently if that's incorrect, if that's like housekeeping versus house cleaning, then I apologize.
Based off of that recommendation. Sam does a lot of those, so that's probably where you get it from.
Yes, he does. Based off of your recommendation.
A bunch of numbers. 12119, whatever. As I'm fixing my hair as you send this message. Matt, there's this thing called a comb. Check into it. By the way, cute sweatshirt, but you guys are doing a great job. Oh, you like my Matt and Kim sweatshirt? They're a great band. Ernest Dude 08, if you want more libertarian callers, call into Alan Combs' show and ask them to come on over. Maybe we should do that. Maybe we should call into other shows as listeners of their shows and then just throw in a, by the way, we work for Sam Seed from Majority Report. If you want to call in if you're a libertarian caller.
Like, hi, Alan, we're calling to lure all your stupid callers.
Maybe he would like that. Maybe he has so many he can't handle them all, and we're going to give him some much-needed reprieve. Hariah Pop Phil, a better question is, how does the Canadian housing bubble continue to inflate and not rupture into the disaster it should be? Well, other than putting bankers in jail that violate the law. Michael's telling me to move on.
I have no idea. That's an interesting. I actually would love to know more about that. If you have any articles to send,
that's
send
why
them
I was
along.
Doing a little bit of. I thought Michael would know a bit more.
I don't know anything about that.
He's our resident foreign news.
Canada's not really foreign.
Oh. Herbowitz, when Sam gets back, I would like to see a regular bit with George Bush, Sam, and Barack Obama, Michael, discussing issues. Herbowitz. Thank you for clarifying who plays which.
Yeah, I like that. I would like to cast Sam Seder as George W. Bush.
Let's go to the phones. 256, what is your name? Hold on, we're having some problems here with the phone. Give me a second. 256, what is your name and where are you calling from? 256, you're up.
Hello?
Hello, 256, I hear you. Yes, that's you. I guess maybe a butt dial. I have no idea. He just hung up.
By the way, you were doing an Obama right there for a second. You did a little bit of a...
256.
256, you. I hear you.
256.
Speak up.
Speak up. Speak up. Back to the IMs. Nelly girl. Canadian banks are very regulated.
Oh, Canadian banks are – I know about the banking regulation. I don't know about the housing bubble in Canada. Canada has extremely well-regulated banks, and they've been able to avoid a fair amount of the crisis as a result of that.
Thank you, Michael. Should we get to some stories?
Please do.
Let's start with – I have so many good ones actually. Let's see what we got here. We really do. All right, let's start with one that's not full blown possibly from the Onion madness. Let's start with this one here from All right, so the NRA's Wayne LaPierre was on Meet the Press this past weekend, and David Gregory decided to ask him, what about what's going on with Mayor Bloomberg? Who, let's talk about Mayor Bloomberg wanting to regulate, how much soda you can drink when you go to the store and buy your big drinks. What size can you buy? What size soda can you buy? How much salt can restaurants put in your food? Mayor Bloomberg, nanny state. And I agree with many of these issues. Mayor Bloomberg is, but is that the important stuff?
I think the gun thing that is one issue that Matt agrees with Mayor Bloomberg on.
I'm critical on Mayor Bloomberg for the silly issues like soda regulation and stuff like that. I'm super critical on Mayor Bloomberg for the absolute lack of care for anyone's civil liberties, stop and frisk. These issues should be the ones talked about, not the soda, not anything else, but those are the issues that should be talked about when discussing Bloomberg. But that doesn't happen, so I'm critical on him on all those issues. But there's one issue, just like Rand Paul, who's right on drones and apparently marijuana, there's one issue Bloomberg is right about, and that's guns. Now, we all know that he has mayors with illegal – his organization, Mayors Against Illegal Guns.
Handguns.
Against handguns.
I think it's Mayors Against Handguns.
No, I think it's Mayors Against Illegal Guns or something that. Well, Cliff Schechter works with their organization. It's a very great organization.
Yeah. Yep.
Just recently, actually, in the special election in Chicago, a candidate, Robin Kelly, who is backed by Bloomberg's organization and received a lot of backing from his organization, she ended up winning on the gun control. She won the campaign, special election, on the gun control issue. And so David Gregory, back to David Gregory on Meet the Press, had Wayne LaPierre on. And let's listen to what Wayne LaPierre had to say about Bloomberg's organization and him putting money into candidates that are for gun control.
They sure don't want him to tell him what self-defense firearms to own, and he can't buy America. He's so reckless in his terms of his comments on this whole gun issue. He talks about guns buzzing. He's talking about machine guns. None of these guns are machine guns.
But is he going to have an impact politically? He wants to be a counterweight to you. He wants to go into these races in 2014 and spend along with you. Are you preparing to arm politically your people who agree with you, candidates and whatnot, in 2014?
We have people all over, millions of people, sending us $5, $10, $15, $20 checks saying, stand up to this guy that says we can only have 3 bullets, which is what he said. Stand up to this guy that says ridiculous things like the NRA wants firearms with nukes on them. I mean, it's insane the stuff he
says. But let me ask.
This is just too cute. This is just cute. I mean, what else
it
can
is,
you...
It's cute.
It's cute. Wayne LaPierre of the NRA talking about how insane the things coming out of Bloomberg's mouth is on guns. This is the same guy who, a week after the Newtown tragedy in Connecticut that left, 20 children dead because of the guns that Bloomberg and many others want, banned from, a regular citizen being able to purchase.
Or at least regulated.
Regulated.
At least have a background check on.
Yes, exactly. Let's take a look at some of the things Wayne LaPierre of the NRA said just a week after this tragedy in Newtown. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. With all the foreign aid the United States does, can't we afford to put a police officer in every single school? Politicians pass laws for gun-free school zones. How many more copycats are waiting in the wings for their moment of fame? I call on Congress today to act immediately to appropriate whatever is necessary to put armed officers in every single school in this nation. These are just things that he said a week after, just to say why we need more guns around schools. And then just some other things he said. How violent Latino gangs are out to get you, and that's why we need guns. They're streaming over our border. That's why we need guns. And so is Al-Qaeda streaming over our borders. Another reason we need guns. Obama wants to take your guns, so we need guns to make sure there's no tyrannical government. If you want gun safety, he said, civilization will collapse. Thanks to Obama, there will soon be no more cops. Cops won't be able to afford police departments won't be able to afford to have so many police officers. So we all need to protect ourselves with guns. The NRA is not paranoid. We just need guns. These are just some of the things that he said. And bringing up the NRA is totally not paranoid thing, he brought up how hurricanes, tornadoes, natural disasters are why we need guns. I guess you could just go outside and shoot at that tornado.
Well, because what happens is opens up the border for Al-Qaeda, who have a secret pathway through the Latin Kings gang, and then they team up together to come steal your TV.
Of course. Of course.
And that's why they're having babies here as we speak.
But it's going to be an uphill battle because, not only does this guy say insane things and do people follow the insanity Wayne LaPierre of the NRA says, but they have massive amounts of money backing them, and they have politicians who are simply paid off to listen to them.
Well, it's a classic example, actually. I think this is like the kind of like flip version. Like Heather was talking about, politicians like a Bloomberg or people in the donor class who maybe they have great views on marriage equality, gun safety, whatever, and they truly will do nothing to help generate opportunity, close extreme inequality. This is like the even uglier cousin of that. This is basically just a gun industry front group that plays off of a small, tiny groups of people's extreme paranoia, fear, and racism to drum up intense pressure on politicians from both a grassroots level and then just through funneling money to their campaigns. And I think, though, frankly, the amount of money that Bloomberg is laying out, I think that probably does start to change the equation a little bit.
Well, not well. Unfortunately, not quite yet. Like we just
maybe down the road.
Special elections, yeah. Things like that. It's been helpful so far, and hopefully, it continues to grow and gain momentum. 2014 will definitely be the election to watch in terms of gun control.
That's what Cliff says.
However, Thursday night, this past Thursday, Congress passed the first federal legislation addressing firearms since the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut. You might think that these new laws would tighten federal restrictions aimed at preventing criminals from getting guns. However, the reality is every single one of these laws that were put in this legislation are ones that are completely promoted by the NRA. And they actually weaken federal firearm laws. Six gun provisions were from Think Progress. Six gun provisions were passed as riders attached to the resolution funding the government through September on Thursday. While all six had been federal law since 2004, and each was approved by Congress on a year-to-year basis, now four of those six provisions that the NRA are for are now permanent. These provisions include, number one, limited enforcement tools against crooked dealers. This rider would prevent the ATF from shutting down gun stores due to a lack of business activity, which is usually a sign of criminal sales. Number two, it would shield gun dealers who lose their guns. This legislation precludes any federal law that requires gun retailers to count their guns and submit the results as a mechanism of determining whether any weapons have been lost or stolen. So, you know, if there's a store out there that just happens to lose these guns, there's no accountability for it. I wonder whose hands these lost guns fall into.
I just want everybody to reflect for a second on the great interview Matt did last week with Tors Eklund, who's the attorney for the AT&T, I don't even know the right word to call him because he's not a hacker, the guy who accessed publicly available AT&T information.
He pointed out a security flaw.
In their system, which was AT&T's responsibility, and now is facing 3 years in prison. Now you have gun laws written specifically. Let's just really hit that home. And Tina Dupuy actually had a great article on this that specifically shield people who make their living selling guns from any consequences from, in the best case scenario, being grossly negligent with a product whose very design is to kill people. And that's still what's passing in Congress a couple of months after Newtown. And not even just
and this
a couple
is permanent
of months,
now.
Just the, and it's permanent. It's a permanent extension. And not just Newtown. You're talking about, you know, just deaths across America every day.
I think Huffington Post was leading this weekend with a story. They've been counting how many gun deaths since Newtown. And I think the number now is up to something like high 2000s, like 2,900 or something like that. Just incredible.
It's really stunning. And I mean, I was saying earlier, I was going off of what Cliff said of 2014 being the year of reckoning. But you're absolutely right that clearly it's not kicked in yet. And this is just... it's stunning in and of itself, and then it's stunning to contrast with the type of punitive measures and really disturbing pieces of legislation that you have targeting people, I think, specifically around technology issues. The contrast is shocking and tells you everything you need to know about what's wrong and skewed in today's politics, frankly.
So exactly. Basically what they're saying is, you know, guns are not that dangerous. You know, we could have lax laws on guns, but if you find a way into a computer system that might have just been left open by some company whose lax care for their customers' privacy just doesn't seem to bother them that their customers' information is out there, if you just happen to stumble across that security flaw in their system, you are more dangerous than someone who could be mentally ill or just has this gun illegally.
That's absolutely right. And follow the logic even more, which is that and what's the similarity? In both cases, the company is totally unaccountable.
In both cases,
the company is totally unaccountable. And that's everything you need to know. So It's just, it's unbelievable.
Another thing to look at here too, to keep in mind, is that as these laws are passing, I'll get to the other two in a second, as these laws are passing, which the NRA are for, they're continuing to push the narrative that your rights, your Second Amendment rights, are being stepped on and destroyed, and they're trying to rally you up. Why? So you send them more money. That's what they're doing. They're getting exactly what they want. There has not been one law passed that they have not approved of in terms of gun laws since Newtown. It's just incredible. And you, the Second Amendment freedom-loving fighters who are going to donate your money to the NRA, who you say are the only organization out there who care about your civil rights, they're doing it to take your money. That's what it's for. Let's get to these other two. Number three. Interfere with the ATF gun trace reports. The ATF is now mandated to include in any reports concerning its tracing of guns back to crime that trace data cannot be used to draw broad conclusions about firearm-related crimes. Academics use this data to do work on guns and have used trace data to firmly establish that several firearm regulations effectively prevent the spread of guns to criminals. Number four. Expand the class of protected guns. According to Roll Call, the fourth permanent law would place a broad definition of antique guns and ammunition that may be imported into the United States. I mean, four laws now that were at least looked at every year, they passed, but at least they were looked at every year, are now permanent after Newtown, when NRA is pushing the story that after Newtown they're being attacked, yet they're getting their way on what they want. With what they want. To give you an example of this, the package on actually tightening gun laws, the one that includes imposing universal background checks and harsher penalties on gun traffickers, that right now is facing a tough fight on the Senate floor because of over disagreements on the consequences of how to enforce background check provisions.
That's
so
right.
So these four laws that the NRA are completely cool with are being pushed through really quickly, no problem, they're not permanent, yet we can't actually get past one law that the NRA actually doesn't like.
That's exactly right.
After Newtown. It's just,
that's exactly right. And it's a paralysis of a process. And I think though, again, I agree with Cliff, and my read is that in 2014 you will start to see some electoral consequences for this. But it's just, it's one of the most cynical and disturbing displays of political influence imaginable. And it's just disgusting. And I mean, you know, what more can you say? As Matt says, right? After Newtown, you can't even pass the most basic things. And these horrific riders are getting flown through the Senate as we speak. It's pretty stunning.
Keep on sending your money to the NRA, folks. They need it. They need all the help they can get.
They need it. They don't, because I'll tell you what, because the NRA is the only thing stopping Ban Ki-moon from going directly to your house and taking away your gun.
Of course. Because, you know, that definitely will
happen. If you weren't doing target practice on, like, old cans of baked beans, I know that personally I wouldn't be able to ride the subway every day. My freedom would be gone.
When I look at the amount of people, just period, who have been killed by guns. Now look at the amount of times the United Nations have entered my home illegally and just interfere with my life. It's important to realize just how much more the UN invading your home affects your everyday life.
No, I know. I mean, I think we can kind of really lose track of the bigger ball here. But if you look at, like, the backs of cereal boxes, we recognize the one world government is going to take us over and sterilize us. I think that puts things in perspective.
I'll guarantee if we polled our listeners right now about how many people have had their families' lives or their own lives affected by guns, and how many people have had their lives affected by the United Nations breaking into their home and jumping all over their civil liberties and rights. When we look at the percentages, pretty sure guns will come out on the bottom of that one.
Of course. Of course.
All right, let's go back to the IMs. Dradmanthes. Eminem, have you noticed how Sarah Palin has morphed into just a weird conservative brand zombie who gets news by wearing a Chick-fil-A t-shirt and drinking Big Gulps? Let's go to the phones. 646, what is your name? Where are you calling from? 646, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Bob, formerly from Albany.
Hey, Bob from Albany. How are you doing?
Yeah, you talked about the Canadian real estate market and whether or not it's a bubble.
Okay.
Well, the Canadian... Hello?
Yeah, I hear you.
The Canadian finance...
Continue.
The Canadian finance minister. Hello?
Yeah, I continue.
The Canadian finance minister, Jim Flaherty, put a limit on the amount of money down you could put, and he cut back on the number of years from 40 years, either down to 35 or 30. So he's trying to slow down the bubble. And where they have a real problem in terms of inflated prices is in Vancouver. And it seems to be unique to the spot because there's not much land that you can develop. So there are many, many apartments, those condos, that are going for insane prices. Outside of Vancouver, there's not really a big problem. In Alberta, they had this huge tar sands, oil sands, bitumen development. So lots of people were drawn to Alberta and Fort McMurray and all the jobs. Just like in Dakota, where they have that gasoline oil drilling boom, where prices for tiny little studio or one-bedroom apartments go for $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, but there's no Manhattan nightlife there. Same thing was happening in Alberta. So the housing market there in that town was being driven by high oil prices. Now that oil prices have come down a bit, Alberta is now going to be $8 billion in deficit as a province.
I think the – thanks so much. No, I just wanted to thanks so much for that, Bob. That's really, really interesting information. I just think the kind of the salient thing besides the Canadian case is looking at, you know, you're going to see this, and this is a totally bipartisan thing. President Obama, the, you know, Republicans, everybody is promoting the shale gas, natural gas boom. And I think, you know, besides the potential environmental, consequences of this, which are very real.
It's a very, very important thing in America. What happens is that gas is not easily exportable, so a lot of manufacturing is coming into the States.
That's right.
To substitute gas, low-priced gas, for other inputs.
That's exactly right.
So when they're talking about a huge manufacturing boom, you have to focus on what industries they're talking about, the very energy-intensive, gas-using industry.
No, that's – thank you so much for the call, Bob. That's exactly right. And I just want to jump off of what Bob said. Because I think that not only is that true, but I think the other really important thing to bear in mind here is, yes, what industries are going to benefit mostly from this? And then the other thing is to really question every time you're at the beginning of one of these booms, you're always going to get the most optimistic estimates of how much of these resources are actually available. So you're going to see a lot of the elements of an internet boom or a housing bubble in this shale gas and natural gas bubble, potentially. I'm not saying definitely, but I'm saying I would be very skeptical of the types of claims that are being made around the resources and the kind of economic environmental sustainability of what's available here. And it doesn't mean that it might not be appropriate energy to access in some ways, but you're going to see a lot – you already are seeing a lot of hype around this. And I think besides the really devastating possible environmental consequences, you're probably just seeing another deeply inflated claim and bubble economy coming up around natural gas and shale gas, and it's already been happening.
What are you talking about?
Thank you for the call, Bob. I just have to give that to Michael.
I wondered why Matt was looking so seriously at me as I did my little shale gas spiel.
Let's go back to the IMs. 100, a bunch of numbers. Play this bit. It's a Glenn Beck audio. It should help you get more libertarian callers. I'll take a look at it after the show. Bad Wagon, call me crazy, but I suspect that if 100 or 200 black NRA members staged a rally brandishing their guns, that whole Second Amendment argument will go away completely and be replaced probably by something even dumber. Left Coast Marcus. Canadian finance minister limited to 25-year mortgage terms. Western Canadian economy is only above water because of tar sands. Also beware of praise of Harper government. I put them in the not a bad guy for an asshole category. They are not fiscally insane, but are socially right-wing and pro-corporate over the needs of the average citizen. Herbowitz. Come on, guys. More people engage in target practice every year than are killed by guns. Therefore, the freedom restriction from gun control is greater than the freedom provided by having gun control. love the black NRA members idea. Someone should stage this and see what happens. That should be like a yes men type
Well, I'm sure that I don't want to jump out on a limb, but I couldn't imagine that the NRA was particularly excited about the Black Panthers. And that's the closest historical reference point I could think. And that's another ironic thing about the NRA, right? Is like all this gun obsession, and then most of the fear stories they have about why you should have a gun is the potential that minorities will come at you with guns. So, I mean, the race stuff in the NRA is totally inseparable from the paranoia and the fear-mongering. No question.
So should we get to this story?
I think you got to get to
this
story.
Might be the highlight of my day, at least. It's the highlight of my day. All right, let me begin this story. Let me start here by saying this is not from The Onion. It's not.
I promise you, folks. I'll validate it. It's not from The Onion.
It's not from The Onion. It's not from The Daily Current. It's not from any other satirical sort of news website there is out there now. This is a story from The Daily Beast titled, Why Tea Partiers Are Boycotting Fox News. Let's find out why the Tea Party is boycotting. And this is true. I looked into it. I found everything they're talking about in this
story. This is a Daily Beast article.
Yes, this is completely true. They begin with, first it was the left turn of Fox News after the election. Fox News becoming liberal media. Fox News becoming liberal media. Then Fox News covered up Benghazi. Activists in the Tea Party now have a list of demands of the conservative network, which some say is not as fair and balanced as I thought. Tea Partiers are organizing a boycott to protest the conservative station's coverage, especially what they view as the network's relative silence in investigating the attacks on a diplomatic mission in Benghazi, Libya.
Can we just... That's amazing.
Hey, what happened?
Is there any news organization out there who has been criticized for their over-the-top coverage and giving more attention than needed to Benghazi than Fox News?
No, I'll tell you this way. I've said this before. Benghazi actually is a serious thing. And Fox News and right-wing media turned what was an absolutely serious thing, ambassadors getting murdered in Benghazi, into a joke precisely because of how absurdly they covered it.
Particularly after the election, Fox keeps turning left, says Stan Hergelide from Fort Collins, Colorado, who has participated in the Fox News boycott. He pointed to an interview of Fox News CEO Roger Ailes, in which Ailes said that the Republican Party and Fox News need to modernize, especially around immigration. We are really losing our only conservative network, Stan said. I can do this story. I don't know if I can do it.
You don't really.
I don't know if I can do it.
I'm just
going
to
read
it.
It's
priceless.
The 3-day boycott lasted Thursday morning through Sunday morning, and it is the second time this group of activists have gone Fox free in an effort to steer the coverage. Organizers say the 2-day boycott earlier this month knocked 20% of the network's regular viewership. A Daily Beast analysis of the same data showed that the boycott had little to no effect. A leader of the boycott, Kathy Amundson of Nashville, declined to give Daily Beast an interview, instead directing the Daily Beast to a website, BenghaziTruth.blogspot.com.
Blogspot.com.
Tea Partiers not really good on the whole registering their own domain thing.
The only serious point to make about this is why they're in such trouble as a party. Because they know that they need to move on immigration. They know they should potentially move on things like marriage equality. If they do, this is their base. So in this silly, ridiculous, nonsensical story, you're seeing a microcosm of why they are trapped. Because of take a look at Benghazi blocks.
This is exactly what we say about the Republican Party. Yeah. It can now be said about conservative media's number one, Fox News. They've created a monster.
Yes.
And they do not know how to stop it because it has grown so big that there is nothing they can do about it now.
That's exactly right.
Let's continue. The website, BenghaziTruth.blogspot.com, is a single page, 23,000 word manifesto, complete with multicolored fonts. I've looked at the site. It looks like something from the old, like, late 90s.
Like GeoCities.
Exactly what I was going to say. It looks like a GeoCities. It's filled with, like, Alice in Wonderland memes with like, liberal things said on it. Like, conservative humor making fun of liberals on it. It's just really funny stuff. That's BenghaziTruth.blogspot.com. The site supposedly has incriminating videos of Fox News' complicity in a cover-up and communist propaganda photographs. The site is kept by someone who identifies himself online as pro-graphique. Other members of the boycott have described him as someone who works in New York media. The website, BenghaziTruth.blogspot.com, reports.
It's Matt Bender.
People ask, why not all mainstream media? Why just boycott Fox? The answer is that Fox needs the Tea Party conservatives and needs the Tea Party and conservatives more than Tea Party and conservatives need Fox. After Fox turned left and sold us out, we are the people who made Fox successful. Organizers then encouraged would-be Fox News viewers to wait until One America, which is supposed to launch this summer as an alternative to Fox. Just sit there and wait for One America, people. That's the network. Is that the network that's run by, that's going to be done by
Glenn Beck?
Is that Glenn Beck's network?
I honestly have no idea.
I'm just excited we'll have a whole new network to pull sound from.
I'm actually personally pretty loyal to Fox.
Yeah.
I feel like Fox, I respected their Benghazi coverage for giving us sound and being totally ludicrous.
Interestingly enough, the night of the first boycott, Fox News host Sean Hannity devoted an entire segment to the Benghazi attacks called 6 Months of Deceit. The organizers didn't watch it since they were boycotting the network. It was too little, too late, they said. We have seen Fox suddenly get very loud about Benghazi after our first boycott. But conservatives are conservatives because they are not stupid. We recognize easily loud noise, which is low on substance. In other words, by whining loudly about Benghazi without the kind of hard-hitting investigative reporting that brought down Nixon over Watergate, what we are seeing from Fox, in my honest opinion, says the website, BenghaziTruth.blogspot.com, is smoke and mirrors, a trick to fool us. Basically, what they're saying is,
don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining.
Amadon and Pographique, who goes by the Twitter handle Frank M. Davis, which is a reference to the leftist poet who conspiracy theorists believe is Obama's real father.
I was going to say that's Obama's dad. These guys are brilliant.
He sends out dozens of tweets every day to ideological allies telling them to boycott Fox News. Let's listen to some of these people who have listened to good old Frank M. Davis over here. I'm having withdrawal. I do like Fox News, says Kevin Avard, a former state lawmaker in New Hampshire who is participating in the boycott.
Oh, my God.
Now, this story just went from, you know, laugh at these people for boycotting Fox News to, holy crap, these people are like, Fox News is a drug to them.
Or how about
Fox,
this guy was
hooked,
a freaking state legislator.
No, but Fox News has them hooked on it to the point where he's literally coming out and saying, this Fox News boycott is causing me to go through withdrawal. If I want news, says Hergelide, who we spoke about earlier in the story, I go to Breitbart News and Drudge, and I can find all the news I need very quickly. He continued. I'm used to having Fox News on all day long. I probably watched maybe 6 hours last week, though. The more I looked at it, I've come to the conclusion that Fox News is not as fair and balanced as I thought. So basically, Fox News isn't as conservative anymore. Fox News isn't as fair and balanced. Which one is it? Or do they really believe that the conservative outlook is the fair and balanced one? There's more, though, sadly.
I don't even know what to say.
There's more.
I don't know what to say.
Donnie Farmer, 48, who works as a chimney sweep in central Pennsylvania and also runs a website, Proud Conservative, who sells right-leaning memorabilia like liberals are friggin' idiots t-shirts.
Wait, what was it again? Liberals are friggin' idiots.
I want it. And bumper stickers that read, 10 out of 10 terrorists recommend voting Democrat. Listen, usually Sam goes through these stories and highlights things to pinpoint. I literally have almost the entire story highlighted.
What
it's
is not to
fun.
Be highlighted?
What is? It's just too much fun. It's too much fun. He said, staying away from Fox News and in particular, FoxNews.com is much harder than he realized. Fox is everywhere. But I've been relying on Glenn Beck's website, The Blaze, to stay informed.
Oh, my gosh. That's just too incredible.
Now, if you thought this story couldn't get any better,
No, it can't get better than this point.
If you thought BenghaziTruth.blogspot.com was the highlight of this story, you are wrong. You were wrong. And let's just get ready for this. Let's see what can I put here?
Just do something. Come with me,
and you'll be here we go. Are you ready? sit back. Grab a drink. Grab a cold. Crack open a cold
crack
one,
open
folks.
A cold one.
Because here we go. Here we go. Here we go. Here, Jad, who was one of the boycotters we've spoken about previously, we need Fox to turn right. That's not it. Hold on. We think this is a cover-up, and Fox is aiding and abetting it. This is the way Hitler started taking over Germany, by managing and manipulating the news media. Folks, we have to stop. We have to stop. We have to stop. Barack Obama. Oh, wait, no. Barack Obama is Hitler.
Barack Obama is Hitler. Excuse me.
We have to get Fox News behind us.
We
have to get Fox News behind us.
We will fight for the motherland, and we will all conform to my dictates and edicts.
We have gotten Fox News in the palms of our hands. They will hail before us.
Oh, my God.
They will... Hail before us, Roger Hales! Roger Hales!
I just can't even process it.
Oh my, this story has everything. It has everything. It literally has everything. Folks, this was not The Onion. This was not The Onion.
That's a real story.
This is real. Benghazi Troop. Let me make sure I get it correctly.
You're going to plug the website again.
You need to check this out. Benghazi-Truth. Which makes me wonder, was Benghazi Truth with no -.blogspot.com taken? Benghazi-Truth.blogspot.com. Check it out, folks. My God. Jeez. Let's go to the IMs.
I just...
Clara. The whole Fox boycott is probably a ploy by One America, and the GeoCities look is probably intentional in order to make the site look unprofessional and grassrootsy. No, I'm going to assume that this is just the best they can do.
That's an interesting theory. Is One America, that must be Glenn Beck's thing, and I wouldn't be surprised if Glenn Beck didn't have some schemes up his sleeve.
Let me tell you, though, this story...
But regardless, even if it's a Glenn Beck plot, that just makes it funnier, okay? Like, you're still getting actual people to say these actual quotes. I mean, it's priceless. It doesn't matter what the reason is.
I guess the story, though, brought a lot of IMs. Let's get that to them.
Please.
Yeah. Bad Wagon. Exactly. Thanks, guys, talking about the NRA thing. I am Jimmy Sullivan. Look at the bright. Look on the bright side. Fox News is now a universal joke. And to that, I am Jimmy Sullivan. I say, now? Now a universal joke?
Well, he means amongst the, but I don't know if that makes them a universal joke, that people who have like taken being a joke beyond Fox joke land thinking it's a joke.
Yeah.
I don't know if that works, but I get what he's saying. Geeky, I get what he's trying.
Geeky dork girl. Bah! Juan Miguel. Love H. John Benjamin's March Madness themed Coke Zero commercials. You should congratulate him. I don't know what you're talking about, Alex. You have to check them out.
Will do.
Kovechkin 178. I'm out of it. Watch out for Rand Paul, arguably the most progressive in the Senate the past 2 weeks on drones, now drug sentencing reform, immigration reform, and voted against Ryan's plan, even though for different reasons. His budget includes giving seniors the Congressional Health Care Act, an upgrade from Medicare. Progressive Democrats can't fall asleep at the wheel on these key issues.
Well, first of all, I agree with the last point. But I'll explain to you why I'm not worried about Rand Paul. One is he is just not a particularly likable or appealing guy, even just as a politician. So the more he's out there, the more he's out exposed and campaigning, I just don't think he's particularly appealing. And I know that that's a very shallow part of the analysis. And I think besides that, look, the guy opposes the Civil Rights Act. I mean – it's going to – and in order to win a Republican primary and square all of the circles he's trying to square, I don't see it happening. And he also voted against the Ryan bill because he has a proposal which overall is much further to the right of the Ryan bill.
Nelly Girl, was that story written by the lady that cussed out everyone on YouTube after Obama won? Remember that lady? What was her name again?
Shelley Dankert, man. That was the best.
Michael, remember Shelley Dankert's name.
I love Shelley Dankert.
Listen, if you're watching this right now, if you're listening, watching, go to YouTube or just Google.
No, she took it down.
Someone has the mirror up for sure. Google Shelley Dankert. It is the greatest video ever. It's just hilarious. I can't even, I can't do justice if I explain. 100, blah, 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 blah. No play the bit on air. It's really funny. How long is this? A minute and 20 seconds. All right, put my phone up. Let's see if this is any good. This is Glenn Beck audio.
All right, you're up. Go ahead.
Are you tired of your government taking away liberties and freedoms you can't quite name? Are your vague platitudes and third-hand anecdotal facts falling on deaf ears? Well, come secede, or sec-D with us, in the Teabagger Utopia.
Glenn, Becky, Stan.
I will personally come to your house and help you pack.
Your hard-earned money is yours to keep. There are no taxes in Glenn.
I thought it was something from Glenn Beck. It's pretty funny, but let's...
I thought it was a Glenn Beck thing.
We need to make fun of it if it was Glenn Beck. Otherwise,
who did that sketch? If it's somebody that you're trying to plug, let us know.
Let's plug them so they could go there and listen, so they could get the views.
Yeah.
We have zero time. We're way over. Should we do this? Should we talk about this, or should we just? This is the last show of the week. Go on vacation. What do you think?
What the hell? Give him one more.
Let's do one more story. This one is interesting. It's very interesting, actually. All right, we've been talking. I interviewed Tor Eklund, as Michael mentioned earlier. Thank you for that, Michael, and your props to that story.
Great story.
This is in the tech world realm. It's not the same as that, but let's get back to the tech world here. There's something that happened over last weekend, I believe, the weekend before last, where there was a 3-day Python programming conference at the Santa Clara Convention Center called PyCon. And a female developer who works for a company called SendGrid, Adria Richards, she was at the conference, and behind her were these two men who worked for Playhaven, which was another tech company at this conference. And these guys apparently were making off-color jokes about dongles. Dongle is like it's a tech term for like, it's a piece of like, it's like an it's accessory. It's what you use, I believe, to like,
Basically, they were being incredibly boring and unfunny.
Yeah, it was just
silly. Just really stupid.
Silly bro-grammar humor. I mean,
is it really at the level of bro?
That's what they're bro-grammar.
Really?
Yeah, that's what they are.
Really, really
unfunny.
It's
a dongle joke. I mean, they said something about forking their dongle or something. Both are tech
terms.
I'm
proud to say I have no idea what any of these
things mean. Both are tech terms. So basically what she did was she heard them talking about this, and she felt like this was inappropriate. She did not like it one bit. She turned around, snapped a photo of them really quick with her phone, uploaded the photo on Twitter, and contacted with, like, you know, at PyCon, who was running the conference, telling them about it. They came in, they took these two guys aside, told them, you know, what you're doing is inappropriate, it's bothering other attendees, don't do this. That's it. That's what happened. People started talking about it online. People started, you know, it was public shaming. I should know about public shaming.
You are the public shaming empresario.
Yes.
The sensei of shame.
Yes. So basically, because everyone was talking about this online, Playhaven, which employed the two guys, felt something had to be done. So they fired one of the developers, the developer who actually made the joke. Now, I think this was a wrong move. Terrible way to handle this. Horrible PR. Whoever's running their public relations should be fired immediately. Because that is a dumb move. What you do here, and I'm not no PR expert, this seems like common sense here, as I lose my...
Good PR is usually common sense.
Yeah, this is just common sense here. What you do is you take the guy aside, you talk to him, and you make it very public that your company will do something to get even just to teach more kids to develop on how to become programmers. Just do something like that. Get females into it. That's basically what I would do if I ran this company.
I would say next time try to be funny.
In the tech world they have a problem. It's a guy's club. The tech world is a guy's club, unfortunately, and it's horrible. And this is why it's a guy's club.
Well,
because of the bro.
So
just the bro culture there.
So is there anything more? Because I had some thoughts on this, but are you still going through?
Yeah, I'm still going through.
Okay, go ahead.
So 4chan got a hold of it. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. 4chan got a hold of it. But what more interesting to me was why Combinator, which runs the Hacker News website. So Hacker News got involved in this. Hacker News is this big, like it's like a Reddit for people who run startups and who work as developers. They got involved with it, which was really, you know, doesn't look good for the tech world that these people who are so into tech are talking about the girl with her name was Adria Richards. I'm all over with this story. Sorry about it.
No worries. Take your time.
Adria Richards, and so they started a campaign. You know, Reddit's men's rights subreddit forum got involved. Just all the worst kinds of people.
That is just so chumpish.
And so there was a denial of service attack on SendGrid, who employs Adria Richards. And so basically, SendGrid's CEO publicly fired her. They put out a tweet saying how she's no longer with the company. She's been terminated. Put on a big explanation on Facebook. Just another, you know, just why would you handle it like that? So basically, we got one silly, dumb, off-color joke that you should not be saying in a public place when you're representing the company you work for. You got a case of someone turning around and snapping a photo and publicly shaming these individuals on Twitter. But, you know, she didn't post their names, any contact details. It was just a photo of two guys. If you didn't know them personally, you would never have a way to do anything about it. To tell them what they did was wrong. And now because of this, you have two people who are fired and two companies that look terrible
I think though what's disturbing to me about this is that it's just this whole ludicrous chain of reactions, to be honest. Like I just want to also think the important addendum to add, which makes this take a really everything about this story is stupid and how it's taking this incredibly ugly turn, because of course as soon as this gets out she's starting to get, you know, rape threats and all. And this is like this whole other part of the culture online, which is so disgusting and disturbing in and of itself. And what you do with public shaming, you highlight those types of things. And that to me is completely different. So I have a problem with every part of this, because to be honest with you, it's like, yeah, you read about it. A couple of, you know, dorky guys are making stupid jokes. They were in no way aimed at her. They had nothing to do with her. And frankly, like, okay, so I admit my bias would be, why does she even care to begin with? But, you know, at any rate, she did. That's fine. That's great. Why are we at a point where, you know, where is this missing? Like, so turn around and say, hey, guys, like, what are you doing?
I agree.
You're being disgusting.
I agree.
Okay, stop it. They probably would have stopped. So first, I think there's this real inappropriate kind of like immediate recourse to I'm going to post pictures of people because they're saying silly things. I think that's off. Then the company's response, firing the guy, is insane.
You know what,
then
she gets
fired, which is insane. And now she's getting threats, which is disgusting and despicable.
I think the two employers come out looking worse than anybody, to be honest.
The employers look reactive and stupid, but I do think that there is a legitimate question as to where are we getting to a point, and I want to be really clear, this is totally distinct from what you do, because you take things like the only port you would get into the story yourself would be
– I would screenshot the tweets that are being
sent
to her.
The threats to her, yes. Because that is the truly – like that is the beyond the pale, despicable behavior that needs to be called out immediately.
What Michael's talking about, by the way, is publicshaming.tumblr.com.
Which is Matt's great website.
Thank you.
But at any rate, what I'm saying, though, is that before you get to that, why is it that like it seems like there's no part in this process from her to them? Like, first, these guys are being stupid and unaware. Then instead
instead of saying,
hey, guys, stop that, she totally escalates unnecessarily. Then the companies fire. It seems nobody's reflecting.
Here. I have something to say about that, though.
Nobody's being reflected.
I'm not saying these two guys would do it, because by all means, the guy who got fired posted something on that Hacker News website.
Right.
And he seemed very apologetic. He didn't blame her, really. He just wished she would have talked to him.
Right.
He was actually really nice on there. I was pretty shocked that he didn't take it out on her.
Well, they look like really nice, cream puffy guys.
But however, there's definitely a culture here where I've seen before. Again, not saying these two guys would have done it, but it's definitely something she might have had in the back of her mind. What if she turned around and said something? And because of just how this bro culture is, where they feed off of each other, they did start directing their jokes and their comments towards her for just turning
around and
saying something.
That's a good point.
I mean, I'm sure she's a smart woman. She seems very intelligent. I'm sure these things all went through her head. I'm sure she just didn't aimlessly turn around and decide to snap a photo.
I guess it's also for me, and I totally own that there's gender privilege here for sure, that's a given. But I also wonder, just literally reading what they said was so silly and innocuous. Like, I don't know how you get through the – like, I hear stuff on the subway that is so so much more extreme than anything remotely compared – or in college or at a conference or anywhere. I don't know how you get through life and if that type of thing upsets you.
But when someone's on the subway or in
– No, I've heard this type of thing at a conference too.
No. Yeah, but
I mean anywhere. I don't know how you could get through life being that upset by that kind of comment.
You are somewhere representing your company, though. They weren't there just as attendees.
Sure.
Their company was one of the sponsors of the event. They were there representing their company. Whether she was right or wrong to post the picture, she very well had a reason to be bothered by it.
But I think the thing that I'm getting at, though, is it's not about her being right or wrong to post the picture. It's that we're at a point where, like, nobody is taking any time to slow down and reflect, right? Like, these guys are stupid. This is the chain. These guys are dumb and unaware. They don't reflect on the fact that they're representing a company. They make stupid, loud, obnoxious comments. She looks at them, and instead of saying, hey, guys, can you quiet down, stop being – whatever. She immediately, you know, publicly shames them on Twitter for, frankly, something that is not really that publicly shameable. Then the companies fire both of these people. It's like – it just seems like there's – everything is at the speed of a text message. There's no point where somebody sits down and goes, okay, we need to take a breath. We need to actually – I mean, particularly when you get to the companies and actually ending people's livelihoods, we need to calm down here and kind of figure something out.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, but another thing to look at, I think, is, I mean, her getting fired because of the outpour of people complaining to this company, SendGrid. I mean, I think, why did they have to take this? Why was there a negative response? I mean, look, the mob, I don't want to call it a mob, but like the voice of many work in this situation. People complained and she got fired. But what if they took the people who did this, took a more proactive role, and instead of trying to get her fired, there was this outcry of, why was this guy fired? Let's start a campaign to get him rehired. And then maybe that company would have had no choice but to rehire him.
Well, but sure, because the people do – well, I mean,
listen,
again,
I bet
again
she,
the people
I bet
who
she
do
didn't
this.
Want, I bet she didn't want this guy to get fired. I could guarantee that. She probably just wanted the conference to take them aside and talk to them, maybe just even boot them from that one specific panel.
When you escalate something to that level,
but I'm sure
you have to know that you're putting people's livelihoods in jeopardy.
I would have never guessed they would have got fired.
I would. I think any time you kind of do something at that level, you're jeopardizing people's livelihoods. And I guess that's what I just wonder. And then I would say what was targeted at her, I just want to make clear again, is a totally separate – like that's when it takes this turn to, at this point, it has to be about protecting and shielding her – because now it's turned into this, you know, all this kind of grotesque stuff that you see online aimed at women. But I think from the beginning, it just seems like, why is nobody having like a pause and some intelligence in this process and some, like, you know, it just doesn't need to get escalated to these extremes. I just don't. I'm not impressed by anybody in this situation, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I agree. Everyone came out. Everyone lost in that one.
Yeah.
I mean, in best case scenario, the developer who got fired and Adria Richards, they get together and form a company that puts the two companies that fired each one of them out of business.
Called Dongle.
Oh, boy. What have you done? Have you done here?
I'm sorry.
What have you done here?
I'm sorry.
What have you done here? You know, I got to give you this.
You are a douchebag.
Wow. I have never abused you with the soundboard like you've abused
All
me.
Right. Let's How get back to it. Oh, we're running really
yeah,
over.
We're running
over
them. We got to wrap this up.
100 with the reply on that sound, that Glenn, that fake, that Glenn Beck parody. It's Kenny Pickles or Kenny Pick. Made that sketch. I read Pickles because I don't know why. It just says Kenny Pick right here, and I said Pickles. Hariah Pop Phil, what did she post a picture of? She posted a picture. She turned around and took a photo. They were sitting right behind her. She turned around and took a photo of them. I guess so she could show the conference which two individuals she was talking about.
She tweeted out two guys making gross comments or something at whatever their conference
was. She didn't
really.
I mean, there's just a photo of them, and she
tweeted it at the... No, she said something about them.
Ernet Dude, 08. Sally Denker, can you guys help with the spelling? is it Sally?
It was, no, Shelly.
Shelly Denker. Denker. Shelly Denker.
So I think it's spelled like
Shelly
right.
Denker. Dankert, I'm going to assume.
U-R-T,
Shelly.
I thought.
U-R-T. Well, just try it. You'll find it.
Yeah, you'll find it. Put Shelly, like, post-election meltdown or something.
121195, bunch of numbers. That was a bit they play on Stephanie Miller's show. I don't remember who produced it. Well, we got it. It's Kenny Pick. We have a final AM of the day here.
Awesome.
Let's do it. Oh, wait. Before we get to the final AM of the day, this is a freebie Monday.
Yes.
And because it is a freebie Monday, as we said earlier in the show, help us not get fired for giving you guys a freebie Monday.
Do the right
thing.
We
did not run this by Sam Cedar. He's going to be just as surprised as you are when he checks iTunes today and finds an almost two-hour show for free.
Yeah.
I mean, we're in big trouble here, folks. So let's get some one-time donations. Let's get some if you were planning on becoming a member last week and you pushed it off because you're a procrastinator like me, I understand. I would say today's the day to do it. If you were going to become a member next week or a month from now, I would say bring that forward a little bit and move that that plan up and do it today. And specifically mention, thanks to Matt and Michael's Freebie Monday, I've decided, you know what? This show deserves my money.
That's exactly right.
Let's do it, folks. Let's get it done.
We can make it happen.
And also, I think it'll help show that me and Michael, we didn't do such a bad job.
No, I would go so far as to say that we've done a good job.
And maybe Sam should, you know, as some people have been clamoring for, give us maybe a show a week. Not of the five shows we do. Like maybe give our listeners a sixth show.
Something like that could happen. All right.
It'll only happen, though, with your membership.
It will only happen with your membership and your support. Let's
so
get
you become the... a, you become a member, support or the show, Majority FM on Twitter, Majority Report on Facebook. Donate your account at donateyouraccount.com, youtube.com/Sam Cedar. Subscribe to us there. Let's get to the final item of the day. And wait, let's go with – we got two just now. I'll get to both. Here we go. Chogged Mox, your hero Scott Prouty is a fraud who hasn't paid his 2002 taxes. Is that – I don't know anything about this.
I don't know.
Scott Prouty is the 47% guy.
I guess I'm assuming that in contrast to the multi-millionaires that you love who don't pay their taxes any year.
Yeah.
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 Anyways, next.
But he just sent something else, a big long paragraph I'm not really going to read because it's just too long via IM. But I would just like to point out that it's sourced from the Daily Caller.
Oh, okay, then I don't believe it. I'm actually going to go and just
you
say
are
on record.
Sourcing,
if you're sourcing from the Daily Caller, and
sourcing,
Scott Prouty has paid every single tax dollar
exactly.
He's owed in every single cycle.
You are sourcing a website that it has just come out that they have quite very possibly paid somebody to make up a story about a Democrat soliciting prostitutes in, where was it again?
Three women in the Dominican Republic have come forward to a lawyer saying that they might have been paid to say that they were paid to have sex with Bob Menendez. And let me tell you something. There's other things about Bob. You don't need to be bribing women to make Bob Menendez look like he has some potential corruption issues. Okay.
And this is our final name of the day. Hariah Pop Phil. Just mention dongles and you can say you need protection. Man, that was a terrible final name of the day. Come on, Hariah Pop Phil. Class the joint up a little bit. Come on. Come on.
And with that, have a great week, folks. We'll be back next week, next Tuesday.
New shows tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and next Monday. We do. We have them.
We got them.
So you will tune in tomorrow and listen to something brand new. It'll be great. I believe we have first up tomorrow is someone, I can't remember his name, from the Working Families Party. I listened to that interview already. It was really, really good. You should definitely take a listen if you care anything about actual work that third parties can do to actually affect elections in our two-party system. It was really good. You should definitely listen to it tomorrow. Listen to it, libertarians. Listen to it, Jill Stein, Green Party supporters. Seriously, take a listen to it tomorrow. It was great.
Have a great day, folks.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost but drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years, while I shifted.